From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Jay McInerney. He became famous in the 80s for his novel Bright Lights, Big City, set in the clubs of downtown Manhattan. Before it was published, he couldn't even get into those clubs unless he was with a cool friend. But after the book, he was made very welcome.
And everywhere I went, people were slipping me grams of cocaine or inviting me into the bathroom to share with them. It became a problem.
McInerney's new novel, Bright Precious Days, centers around a middle-aged couple who've been married for 25 years, and the relationship has become routine.
Which leads to the question, do I accept this state of affairs, or do I seek that incredible experience of lust, of passion, of sex somewhere else?
And Ed Ward remembers the pop music scene of the 70s and early 80s in Dusseldorf. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jay McInerney became famous in the 80s for his semi-autobiographical novel Bright Lights, Big City, about a 24-year-old who works as a fact-checker for a magazine in New York and spends his nights partying in the cocaine-dusted clubs downtown. It was adapted into a film starring Michael J. Fox. McInerney's new novel, Bright Precious Days, is the third in a series that follows the story of a couple, Russell and Corrine Calloway. The new novel is about marriage, fidelity, and middle age. It's also about writing. Russell is an editor and publisher. Bright Precious Days is set in New York between 2006 and 2008, allowing McInerney to continue to write about a subject that fascinates him, how New York is constantly changing. Jay McInerney, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the very beginning of your new novel.
Once, not so very long ago, young men and women had come to the city because they loved books, because they wanted to write novels or short stories or even poems, or because they wanted to be associated with the production and distribution of those artifacts and with the people who created them. For those who haunted suburban libraries and provincial bookstores, Manhattan was the shining island of letters. New York, New York. It was right there on the title pages, the place from which the books and magazines emanated, home of all the publishers, the address of the New Yorker and the Paris Review, where Hemingway had punched O'Hara and Ginsberg seduced Kerouac, Hellman sued McCarthy, and Mailer had punched everybody, where, or so they imagined, earnest editorial assistants and aspiring novelists smoked cigarettes in cafes while reciting Dylan Thomas, who'd taken his last breath in St. Vincent's Hospital after drinking 17 whiskeys at the White Horse Tavern. These dreamers were people of the book. They loved the sacred New York texts, The House of Mirth, Gatsby, Breakfast at Tiffany's et al., but also all the marginalia, the romance and the attendant mythology, the affairs and addictions, the feuds and fistfights. Like everyone else in their lousy high school, they'd read The Catcher in the Rye, but unlike everyone else, they really felt it. It spoke to them in their own language, and they secretly conceived the ambition to one day move to New York and write a novel called Where the Ducks Go in Winter, or maybe just The Ducks in Winter. Russell Calloway had been one of them, a suburban Michigander who had an epiphany after his ninth-grade teacher assigned Thomas's Fern Hill in honors English, who subsequently vowed to devote his life to poetry, until a portrait of the artist as a young man changed his religion to fiction.
So, Jay, what did New York mean to you when you moved there, and when did you move there?
New York meant many of those things. I really believed somehow that it was the center of the literary world. It was Mecca for somebody who really cared about literature and wanted to create it. There was something else going on at the time, too, though. I had actually been on a fellowship in Japan, and I'd been hearing rumblings and in fact, music emanating from downtown Manhattan, from the Lower East Side. The music that was coming from CBGBs, and I was hearing, I was hearing about painting and the art world sort of being revived in downtown galleries. I was hearing about these, night spots like Max's Kansas City, and this was late 1979 when I moved to the city, and suddenly I just couldn't wait to get there.
What place did you hope to find for yourself in this city that you had dreamed about?
Well, I imagined a place somewhere between the sort of downtown art scene and the kind of the slightly more staid quarters of the literary establishment. I think at that time, the literary establishment specifically was centered in two places: George Plimpton's townhouse on 72nd Street, which was the home of these extraordinary parties, where, in fact, eventually I met people like Norman Mailer and Gay Talese and Truman Capote and Robert Stone. This was, in fact, not only George Plimpton's home, but also the offices of the Paris Review, which was a very special magazine to anybody who cared about fiction and poetry. And also there was the New Yorker, you know, which had been for 50 or 60 years the voice of New York sophistication and the home of many of the writers that I admired. And in fact, not long after moving to New York, I got a job at the New Yorker as a fact checker, and I sort of felt that I'd really arrived.
Of course, fact checking is a part of your first big novel, Bright Lights, Big City. So, you know, the people who you mentioned by name, most especially like Norman Mailer, George Plimpton, these people were like big personalities. And mm-hmm. The New Yorker at the time was just filled with mythology about its great writers and its great editor, William Shawn. Did you feel like you could ever inhabit that kind of big persona to be on a level with the people who you so admired and the mythologies around them?
Well, I think when you're in your early 20s, you're not quite smart enough or not quite humble enough to realize that this is a very tall order, and I guess I somehow imagined taking my place among them, and I was fortunate, in fact, in having a lot of these people adopt me to some extent. A lot of these older writers did take me under their wing, often without much evidence that there was any reason to. But the New Yorker, on the one hand, was a very daunting place, and a place where fact checkers really weren't supposed to talk to the editors and the writers. But though, in fact, I did find some nurturing spirits there. Later, after I had been fired from the New Yorker and sent packing, I sent a short story to George Plimpton, who I'm very grateful to say found something in it, and he didn't publish that story, but he did publish a subsequent short story, and I was I suddenly found myself welcomed into the fold. I found myself attending a cocktail party amongst these literary giants.
Getting fired from the New Yorker, which you just referred to, is not something you put on your resume.
Well, it's not. You know, I think subsequently I could brag about it. Apparently, I was the first person. The legend is I was the first person ever fired from the New Yorker. It's
way to go.
It's a bit like the Ivy League. You know, once you're in, they work hard to keep you in.
So what did you do to earn the honor?
Well, I was a very bad fact checker. You know, I wasn't very interested in facts. I didn't want to be a fact checker so much as I wanted to be in the pages of the New Yorker as a short story writer. And fact checking, you know, is a very methodical, not to say tedious profession. And
But very important.
Very important. I just wasn't very good at it, and I don't think it helped that the final straw was my less than impeccable fact checking of an article about the French elections back in the early 80s, and I had somewhat foolishly put fluency in French on my resume as one of my qualifications, when in fact I wasn't fluent in French. And to check this particular article, I had to call France and often speak to people who didn't speak English. And so the fact checking suffered. And when the article came out, certain errors were discovered, and I was exposed, and very very quickly asked to leave the magazine.
What did that do to your career as a liar?
Well, you know, in retrospect, I think that it turned out to be a very good thing for my career as a fiction writer, as a novelist, because When I was fired from The New Yorker, I was confronted with the challenge of actually making good on my ambition and my dream to become a novelist. And I had to put up or shut up. And
But getting back to my question, after you got fired because you'd lied twice, you lied about being fluent in French, and then you compounded the lie by saying you'd fact-check things that you actually hadn't really fact-checked.
Mm-hmm.
Did that caution you about lying, or did you feel like, well, it worked out okay? And
I don't know whether
lying was... A lot of people lie when they get started in whatever they're doing because they have no experience, so they figure they'll...
Yeah.
Fake their way through their first job, but
no, I was mortified about my dishonesty and my mistakes. I was extremely, you know, ashamed and depressed, and I didn't want to. You know, it was one of the real low points of my life, and it was compounded by the fact that my first wife had just recently left me for a photographer. She'd gone to the spring shows in Milan. She was a model, and had never returned. And my mother was dying of cancer at the time. So it was a real low point, and I felt. You know, I felt ashamed of the fact that I was at the age of 23. I felt I was a failure, and I was washed up, and I had no one to blame but myself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jay McInerney, and he's written the third in a trilogy of novels, and the new book is called Bright Precious Days. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Jay McInerney, who's best known for his first novel, Bright Lights, Big City. His new novel is called Bright Precious Days. The main character, Russell, in your new novel, is an editor who started off as a writer but realized he'd never write as well as his best friend. And Russell realizes he'd be more convincing as an editor. He'd be more the Maxwell Perkins type. So...
Right.
He sees his job as chipping away at excess prose, making it more streamlined and in focus. And when he hears one of his authors read a story that he's edited, and it goes over really well at the reading, he feels so good about it. And he prides himself on doing all this without interfering with the writer's voice. But later, a writer drops him because he thinks that Russell is imposing his rhythm and changing the writer's voice. This is the kind of writer-editor relationship you must have thought about a lot in your years as a writer, especially because one of your best friends, your former college roommate, Gary Fiskejohn, is one of the most celebrated editors in America, and I believe he's your editor.
Gary is my editor. He has been my editor from the beginning. He published my very first novel, and he published this one. And... I think it's a little unusual, the continuity, the longevity of our relationship in the current publishing climate. But, you know, it used to be the norm.
One of the issues in your novel is that the editor is editing a book by his best friend, and his best friend has died before the novel's completed. So the editor had to face the question, is he going to impose his version of the story on this novel that he's editing? Because a couple of the characters in the novel are based on the editor and his wife. Now, since Gary Fiskejohn is your former college roommate, he must know a lot about you. must know your secrets and stuff. And so it must be interesting, in some ways good and in some ways uncomfortable, to be edited by someone who knows you so well.
Well, you know, it's funny. Gary does know me as well as anyone, I suppose. But I think that what's great about our editorial relationship is that what we have in common, first of all, is this body of reading. When I first met him at Williams, we started exchanging books. Raymond Carver's first book was the first one that I gave to him. He forced Faulkner on me, someone who up to that point I didn't really appreciate, and so on, back and forth. And over the years, we've been reading the same books and corresponding about them and talking about them late at night. So we have this kind of amazing shared frame of reference, which I think really comes in handy when he sits down to look at my manuscripts. You know, the personal stuff is indeed complicated, although it almost surprised me on this recent novel, because it had been a while and because this is a book that deals in relationships between writers and editors. How strangely professional the whole thing was. I mean, Gary, at no point did he object to, the portrayal of Russell in relation to the writers in the book, and we never talked about the ways in which, you know, Russell's opinions and Russell's identity might reflect Gary or the ways in which the writer editor relationship might be a commentary on our own. I found that kind of surprising. I really wondered if we were going to get into anything personal when he first read this book.
Are you relieved that you didn't?
He's a pro. and I, you know, I think he's, I don't know, I think he was probably amused by some of the ironies and some of the sort of veiled forms of communication between us that take place on the pages of the book.
One of the conflicts between the editor and one of his writers is the editor emphasizes economy and is always kind of chipping things away, making them shorter, more concise. And
yes,
the writer is saying that for him it's more about rhythm. And at some point he feels like the editor is stifling the writer's voice. And the writer asks, like, why is shorter necessarily better?
Yeah,
and I feel like I can answer that as a reader.
Please do.
Well, if you read as many books as I do for interviews, brevity is to be valued. but also as a reader, I think so many writers really do go on too long. But is this a conflict that you've had with Gary Fiskejohn as your editor over economy versus rhythm? Do you see them as in conflict, economy and rhythm?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily in conflict. I mean, you know, Hemingway was one of our most economical writers, and he had an extraordinary sense of rhythm. I think my point sometimes when I'm discussing my prose with my editor is that, you know, I have tried to be economical, but I have also tried to create a sentence which has its own internal logic and rhythm, and saving three or four words at the expense of, you know, of disassembling the sentence and putting it back together, you may be losing something that I've felt very long and hard about. Mm-hmm. And once in a while I say it's not my job to save trees, you know. but on the other hand, you know, Raymond Carver was my mentor, so I like to think that I'm not insanely prolix. And in fact, I try to trim my own work even before I show it to my editor.
Do you remember a specific thing about writing that Raymond Carver shared with you that's stuck with you and helped guide you?
Yes. Carver used to go over my stories with me in his office, And he would really go through them line by line. And he was not someone who had an overarching theory of fiction so much as he had a great intuitive feel for the process. And one of the things I remember most distinctly was Ray turning to me one day and saying, you know, now why are you using the word earth here? What you really mean is dirt. Why don't you just say dirt? He said, you're sort of seeking a grandiosity that you don't need. He said, say what you mean and say it in the most direct way that you can. And I felt for many, many years afterwards as if there was a small Ray Carver standing on my shoulder, you know. Whenever I reached for the sort of $15 word, sort of like, you know, gently admonishing me and say, dirt, it's dirt.
My guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel is called Bright Precious Days. We'll talk more about writing, marriage, and how Bright Lights Big City changed his life after we take a short break. And rock historian Ed Ward will play tracks from the German pop music scene of the 70s and early 80s, a scene that influenced David Bowie and Brian Eno. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years, and from ADT Security, helping to protect families and homes for over 140 years. Learn more at ADT.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jay McInerney. He's best known for his novel Bright Lights, Big City, which was set in the downtown Manhattan club scene of the 80s. His new novel, Bright Precious Days, is his third in a series about a couple named Russell and Corrine Calloway. It's set in New York in the aughts. Your novel is in part about relationships, and more specifically, about a couple in middle age who's been married for a long time. They have two twins. They're 49 or 50 through the course of the novel. And so the novel is in part about fidelity and whether a marriage in middle age can hold together after either an affair or after somebody has really seriously considered an affair. And it's about whether you're any more or less reluctant to embark on an affair in middle age when you've been in a marriage for a long time. So I'm interested, I should mention you've been married four times.
I have been.
And so
sounds terrible when I say it, but.
So I'm interested in your interest in fidelity and monogamy.
Well, I think I mean, I think the first thing to say about that is that there's no drama and not much story in an entirely faithful marriage. Infidelity is one of the great plot engines of literature. So, in fact, this book is the third in the series dealing with Russell and Corrine's marriage, and I started the first book, Brightness Falls, with the notion of the perfect couple. You know, I think we're all when we're in our 20s, we all know that couple, or perhaps there are two or three. They're smart, they're good looking, they get married young, they seem to have solved the romantic riddle early in life, and you know, they have cocktail parties. And I knew several of these couples when I was a young man when I first arrived in New York, and I idealized them as did their other friends, and that was sort of the initial notion of Russell and Corrine Calloway. But of course, it's an entirely unrealistic one. And in fact, I'm thinking of three couples that I vaguely had in mind when I set out to create Russell and Corrine. And of course, they all blew up within a few years. Mm-hmm. And but as someone who was already on his second marriage when I conceived this first book, I was intrigued by the idea of a marriage that survives. And it survives crises, and it survives infidelity. I had already failed to be that person, to be that husband within a monogamous relationship.
Because this couple was middle-aged, they're around 50, and their friends, a lot of their friends are about the same age.
They turn 50 in the course of the book.
Yeah, yeah, the waning of their sexual passion for each other is part of what you explore in the novel. Cialis has started to enter the picture for some characters. and one of the characters, I'm trying to remember, I think it's Corrine says, we're 50 years old, where's the romance? Did you want to reflect on the relative importance of sex in marriage during middle age?
Well, yeah, I think that question is at the center of this book. Russell and Corrine have been together for 25, 26 years, and it's hard to sustain passion. It's hard to sustain physical attraction when so much of your relationship is tied up in the mundane realities of domestic life, you know, laundry, taking the kids to school and play dates. There are many, many virtues to a longstanding monogamous relationship. And in fact, this book, I think, celebrates many of them. But I think that the kind of desperate passion and physical desire that characterizes all relationships in their earliest days inevitably fades, which leads to the question, do I accept this state of affairs, or do I seek that incredible experience of lust, of passion, of sex somewhere else? And that's where Corrine finds herself in the beginning of this book.
How has your career as a novelist turned out compared to what you expected after Bright Lights, Big City was published and became this like huge success and was adapted into a film?
Well, before Bright Lights, Big City, I'd really just been hoping that the publication of the novel would lead to, say, a teaching job or a job in journalism or something, because I'd actually worked at Random House, and it was very I'd seen many first novels published to no acclaim, virtually no feedback whatsoever. So I was shocked by the acclaim and the attention that Bright Lights, Big City received, and you know, now for quite a while, I guess I was disoriented by it, And I think it would have been hard to know what to expect after that, except that I realized that it was a very hard act to follow. You know, a novel that becomes a kind of a cultural touchstone and sells hundreds of thousands, well, millions of copies around the world. And I suppose I struggled to live up to the expectations created by that novel. And some might say I failed. On the other hand, I think that when I discovered these characters, Russell and Corrine Calloway, and wrote my fourth novel, Brightness Falls, I think I really found myself as a writer in a way that gave me a second life as a writer, and that in fact is my favorite of all my books, and I'm grateful to Bright Lights Big City that it gave me a full-time writing career. I was able from that moment forward to do the thing that I love the most.
Because cocaine figured so prominently in Bright Lights Big City, and I'm sure you were doing some at the time that you wrote it, did it make it any harder or easier to eventually give it up? Because it became so, you know, you became so identified with that scene and with that drug, which you named Bolivian marching powder.
Well, yeah, there was a problem in that after I published Bright Lights Big City, so many people wanted me to be that character, and it became a kind of badge of honor to party with Jay McInerney and do cocaine with him. And I, in the days when I was sort of researching Bright Lights, not that I realized I was researching it, I, you know, I could barely get into these nightclubs, and I had to go with my cooler friends, and suddenly after Bright Lights, I was welcome at all of these places, and everywhere I went, people were slipping me grams of cocaine or inviting me into the bathroom to share with them so they could tell their friends that they had done it. And it became a problem. I mean, it was very hard to shake that image, number one, and number two, when the time came that I felt I should stop, it wasn't easy. I felt like I had partly created a scene which had then engulfed me and kind of trapped me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jay McInerney, and his new novel is called Bright Precious Days. Jay, let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week, from grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns. Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices. And from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Jay McInerney. His new novel is called Bright Precious Days. You're married now to Anne Hurst, who also has issues with the spotlight because she's from the Hurst family. She's
yes,
one of the heirs to the Hurst fortune.
She's
the sister of Patty Hurst.
She's managed to stay pretty far away from the spotlight, except for perhaps for marrying me.
and her name, of course, is...
Her name does follow her around. But,
right. So if I might ask, what was it like for you to get to know someone who is Patty Hearst's sister? Because I'm sure you came of age with a Patty Hearst story. And, you know.
It's
one of like the seminal 60s or early 70s. I forget the year.
70s.
Yeah, 70s. Stories. Because she was kidnapped by this like bizarre, cultish, radical group that had, as far as I can tell, a totally incoherent ideology.
They, They really did. There was like seven of them, and they really, their program was sort of mixed up and contradictory, and the other revolutionaries didn't even know who they were.
So anyway, walking through a door into the mythology of all of that.
Yeah, well, it was, the Patty Hearst story, it riveted me as it did the rest of the nation when I was a young, I guess I would have been a teenager. So when I met Anne, I had my preconceptions, and she had this sort of halo of mythology around her, even if she wore it lightly. I mean, it's not just Patty too. I mean, her grandfather was an extraordinary historical figure.
William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper publisher,
was one of the titans of the 20th century. And it was curious meeting her. But in fact, she's a very unassuming and mild-mannered person. And when I met her, in 1986, at a nightclub, I might add, she was working as an assistant editor in Town and Country magazine. And, she had a very, she had a very quiet life. And she was then and remains a very quiet and modest person who happens to have this, I guess, tempestuous family history. I think that in the same way that my post Bright Lights reputation must be a bit of a burden, I think probably that her family history is a bit of a burden, but she wears it very lightly.
So, on another note, your book is bookended by two elections.
Yeah.
So we all remember the John Edwards scandal when he had to remove himself from the primary because of his relationship with Riel Hunter, who it turned out he had fathered a child with outside of his marriage.
What was he thinking?
Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, at some point probably before that, you had dated Riel Hunter, that same woman?
Well, I dated Riel a very long time ago, a year or two after I published Bright Lights, Big City. So I guess that would have been 86 or so. And she had just come to New York. And we parted on good terms and, stayed somewhat in touch over the years, so that I was, still in touch with her and communicating now and then when all of this began. And it was it was quite a thing to watch unfold.
What was that like for you to know the person at the center of this like huge political scandal?
It was kind of horrifying because I didn't see how it could end well, and I was privy to this secret before it was revealed. And
really?
Yes, and as someone who is a great admirer of John, who was an admirer of John Edwards, I was concerned. And as someone who was a friend of Riel, I was concerned. It was one of those great sort of tragedy slash farces of recent political history. But it has an extra resonance, an extra sting if you happen to know one of the parties involved. I was dragged into it once things started to unfold because Riel many years ago had given an interview to Vanity Fair in which she had said that she was the model for the main character in my novel, The Story of My Life. And there was some truth to that. She was certainly She was certainly a big inspiration for that character. So when the scandal started to unfold, the only public profile that she had was in relation to me and this book. And so suddenly I was inundated. You know, there was about a week there when the scandal unfolded, when I couldn't really answer the phone or leave the house.
So I want to end with a quote from E.L. Doctorow that you've referred to. And I know this quote, and I can't remember whether I'd read it someplace or whether he also said it on the show after saying it in other places, but but the quote is, writing a novel is like driving cross-country at night. You can only see as far as the headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. I love that quote because to me that describes my life. Don't ask me ever for 5-year goals or anything. Like, I have no idea ever what's in the future, but I could see far ahead enough just to take like the next step forward. What does that line mean to you?
Well, I actually interviewed E.L. Doctorow when I was a young writer before I published Bright Lights, Big City, and I think I elicited that quote now, and it may be that he'd been using it for many years before that.
So maybe I have you to thank
for
that quote.
I remembered it extremely well and wrote it down, and it meant a lot to me because I felt the same way about writing novels. You know, writers as diverse as John Irving and Scott Fitzgerald and Bret Easton Ellis have said that they plan and outline their novels. And that they have a very elaborate plan before they start writing. You know, John Irving once told me he wrote the last chapter first, so he knew where he was going. But for me, that's just impossible. And I feel that a lot of the most interesting stuff happens along the way at the level of language and is improvised.
Do you feel the same way about your life, that you can't see any further than past the headlights?
Yes, I honestly can't say that there's been a master plan, except insofar as I always wanted to. I mean, from the age of 13, I wanted to be a writer. Initially, I wanted to be a poet, and then subsequently, I wanted to be a novelist. And I have remained true to that vision, and I've been lucky enough to be able to do it. All the rest would have been very hard to predict, and any master plans that I have made have been radically revised.
Jim McInerney, thank you so much for talking with us again, coming on the show. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Jim McInerney's new novel is called Bright Precious Days. After we take a short break, Ed Ward will play tracks from the German pop music scene of the 70s and early 80s, a scene that influenced David Bowie and Brian Eno. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. If someone were to ask you where Germany's hottest music scene in the late 70s and early 80s was, you'd probably think Berlin. Or you might consider Cologne, home of many of the progressive krautrock bands. But a more accurate answer might be Dusseldorf, where some interesting characters helped start a new German pop scene, which was documented in a recent book and 2 CDs of rare tracks. Rock critic Ed Ward has the story. Thank you.
In 1975, Klaus Dinger broke up the band Neu, a minimalist, noisy outfit that had grown up when Dinger and his friend Michael Rotter left Dusseldorf's best-known band, Kraftwerk. He grabbed his brother Thomas and a studio technician he'd worked with, Hans Lampe, went into the studio and, as La Dusseldorf, released an album leading off with the 13-minute Dusseldorf, an unclassifiable but catchy piece of music. In order to understand the humor of this, you've got to realize that Dusseldorf was long one of Western Germany's more boring cities. It doesn't have a particularly long history and is a center of finance and fashion. That industry reached out to Japan several decades ago, with the result that Dusseldorf has a large Japanese population. The Rhine flows through the city, and the 19th century poet Heinrich Heine lived there until he moved to Paris. That seems to be what its young people do, move. But Neu and Kraftwerk were on the avant-garde end of krautrock, not the sludgy guitar end, and when David Bowie heard La Dusseldorf, he proclaimed them the soundtrack of the 80s. Meanwhile, Dinger's former partner in Neu, Michael Rotter, was out in the countryside with two other guys who called themselves Mobius and Rodelius, making music as Harmonia. Their odd experiments inspired Brian Eno to visit and record with them on his way to Berlin to produce Bowie in 1976. Meanwhile, in the city itself, a punk scene was born in a small bar, the Rattinger Hof. Besides the usual guitar shenanigans, there was a heavy electronic element to the music happening there. The first band to get recognition was DAF, an ironic abbreviation for Deutsch-Amerikanische Freundschaft, German-American Friendship. The duo, Gabi Delgado Lopez and Robert Girl, were out to shock, with a very homoerotic stage act, a refusal to sing in English like most current German acts, and their first single, Der Mussolini. With lyrics telling us to do the Mussolini or the Adolf Hitler, DAF wasn't focused on airplay, especially not at home. But they did shock the young punk scene into realizing the German bands could, and maybe should, sing in German. Thus was born the NDW movement, Neue Deutsche Welle, or New German Wave. And more synth bands at the Rattinger Hof.
Tanzen, komm mit Twist.
Das Ding gebaut, wonach schreit der Mensch von heute? Wer hat mein Gehirn geklaut? Ich fragte Leute auf der Straße, in der U-Bahn, im Büro. Alle wollen Computer haben, keiner weiß genau wieso. Gib mir Parallelschnittstelle 64-Bit, Professor Fortran, Logo, CPU und Physikal und RAM-Modul. Hinterlist und Floppy-Chip, Pershing 2 und Apple Panic sind die Russen unsere Feinde. Ach, die Welt ist so verwirrend.
Papi, schenk mir einen Computer, Hilfe! Für die ganze Familie, Liebling, nimm die Rüstungsspirale, tanz den Gummi-Twist.
Their plan was even more mechanical than DAF, with a more cautious sense of humor, and managed to have a modest career in Germany. But the idea of NDW soon caught on with a lot of bands, not all of whom were as avant-garde, and most of whom, of course, didn't live in Dusseldorf. The city's local hero started doing side projects, breaking up and reforming, and enjoying a little success in England, where the New Romantics listened closely to the synthesizers, and bands like Visage and Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark showed their influence. I only visited Dusseldorf once, on assignment to cover a show in one of the art museums, documenting the punk scene there, not particularly well, as I reported. But there was nothing to listen to. And I always considered Dusseldorf bands like Kraftwerk and DAF to be from Cologne. The only specific piece of music I associated with the city was an NDW remake by La Dusseldorf of their signature tune. I liked it.
Ed Ward is the author of the forthcoming book, The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 1, 1920 to 1963. The music he played is from Electricity 1 and 2 on Groenland Records. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about our illogical brain and why it isn't necessarily like a computer. My guest will be neuroscientist and columnist Dean Burnett, author of Idiot Brain. We'll also hear from comic Ali Wong, who was 7.5 months pregnant when she recorded her comedy special, which Marc Maron called the most honest, rawest, funniest special I've seen in years. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Sam Brigger. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Organic Valley, a farmer-owned cooperative committed to the craft of organic farming, makers of Organic Fuel, a protein recovery shake designed for everyday athletes. Organic Valley, bringing the good. And from the Gene Schultz Trust, supporting Canine Companions for Independence, a nonprofit working to enhance the lives of children, adults, and veterans with disabilities by providing assistance dogs, where help is a four-legged word, at cci.org.